All right, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I suppose this is season number three. I think that's how we're going to sort of like bill it, really. Because season two was there, the 50 greatest moments. We sort of rounded that up. We're going to have the results next week because we've only had one person that's actually done the list so far, and that's Flynn. And obviously, we're going to know which sporting moment's going to be top there, don't we? The Hell in the Cell, it's got to be.
Classic, definitely not Phelps, mate.
Phelps definitely again. I don't think he was even allowed to be on it because of that red card. I'm still kind of like upset about that, but I'm not going to go on about it too much. So obviously I'm Mandy Bissett. I'm joined by James Allen and Liam Flynn once again. And I've literally in the last 30 minutes thrown in this preamble ramble just because it's about the Club World Cup, and I didn't really know it was going on. I completely forgot about it until I saw it in the news. And there was a game on this morning, and I think it was Monterrey versus Al Hilal or Al Azri, one of the Owls. And it was just on the TV, like when I was in the gym, and I was like, what's this game's going on? Yeah, Club World Cup. And what is the actual point of it? I mean, like last year's Champions League winners, Chelsea, obviously they're going to be up against the CONCACAF league winners, Monterrey. The CONCACAF Champions League winners, Monterrey, along with Al Hilal and Al Jazeera, who I thought were a news channel, but they're also a football team. It might be slightly differently spelled in there. So, but this tournament is supposedly meant to bring together the best domestic talent from across the globe, from each of the world's confederations. But it garners absolutely zero interest in the footballing world. Why is this?
Because there's a clear hierarchy of quality and talent between all the different continents. So you're not going to get excited about a team like Chelsea, who, even though they won the Champions League, they're probably not even the best team in Europe. Would you ever pick a team from anywhere in Asia to do anything against Chelsea in a meaningful game? Really?
Well, nah, and to be fair, it's a bit raving, really, because Chelsea get a bye to the semi-final anyway, so they only got to win two games to win the FIFA Club World Cup. So it's like all these teams that are from, like, I think there's one from Saudi Arabia. There's one from like Tahiti. And it's just like, well, I won from obviously the South American Confederation, which is kind of the only meaningful opposition that any sort of team from UEFA are going to face. I think in three times in the 22-year history, it hasn't been UEFA Confederation team. It's been two Brazilian teams. Corinthians have won it twice and Sao Paulo have won it the other time. So it's basically like there's no substance to it at all. Do you know what I mean? So I just don't see the point. I think they should just bin it off.
I tried to find an argument against you here on this one, Bissett, and it was pretty difficult, I've got to say.
You did only have half an hour to formulate an argument. even with a day's formulation of an argument, I don't think you could come up with one.
Well, I found an article from the BBC, and they give 5 points why you should watch the Club World Cup this year. Do you want to hear a couple of them? See what you think of them?
Yeah, let me guess. It's inclusive. It's inclusive to all races and religions. I bet you that's one of them.
It says the chance to watch teams you've never heard of. What do you make of that?
I'd watch fucking the FA Cup, like early rounds between Boreham Wood and bloody Dagenham and Redbridge if I wanted to see players I've never heard of.
They also say it's the dress rehearsal for the World Cup because it's going to be in similar conditions. So they're both going to be in Qatar. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. So yeah, that is right. So they always do it. They always do it the year before the World Cup, or in this case, it's going to be in the same year, but obviously in about 9 months' time. Yeah. So that is the point. I think that is probably the only reason they do it, because I remember, what was it, the early days? I think it started in like 2000. So I think one of the first ones was just before the Japan. So 2002 World Cup in Japan. So yeah, that is bang on. That is the only reason I can think of why they still keep it on, to be fair.
And one last point they've given is there's a chance to see Gabigol again.
Gabigol? What's that?
Yeah. They say, maybe I'm saying it wrong, a Flamengo striker, Gabriel Barbosa, commonly known as Gabigol. He's always worth a what?
No. I'm not. Call me cynical. Exactly. This feels like a cash grab. It does feel just like, let's get the most commercially viable clubs from across the planet and put them on the pitch together in a semi-competitive environment, and let's just rake in the dough. Now, I don't want to accuse FIFA of being non-trustworthy or elevating financial success above the fair principles of competition. But it does kind of feel like that. What do you reckon, Bissett?
Yeah, I know your cynicism would get wormed in there somehow. I've just looked at Gabigol. He's he played for Santos for 3 years, and that's where he started his career. And he sort of was okay there, scored 34 goals and 130 appearances. Certainly no Pelé levels. He was then signed by...
Whoa. I thought Pelé was fucking average, mate. I remember that from a couple of episodes ago.
Pelé levels.
Isn't that absolutely average? Like,
I've never said Pelé's average. I'm just saying, like, he was probably scoring goals against the reserve teams and, like, counted him in his 1,000 goals or whatever he said he scored.
I reckon that's bang on before.
I remember it word for word. It was one of the early episodes when you boys had just started and you were like, I'm just going to put it out there. I don't think Pelé's all that.
I think we immediately lost 50% of our followers in the following week after that. So the stats say. But he didn't do much at Inter Milan. He was there for 4 years, scored one goal in 9. So I don't know what BBC are talking about, man. I think I don't want to slag him off too much, though, because Jim's got an application in the post. So
yeah, I'll have to start calling Tim Henman a nonce, won't I? But only when I get hired.
I reckon that's why I didn't get this job last week. I think in that interview with that John Curtis, maybe I was just slagging off the class of 99 too much, man. I might have called him pedos, but I'm not 100% sure.
I probably called him pedos, but also I linked in the BBC Hub application. You have to put up like an example of your work. And I put in part two of the top 50 sporting moments. And I'm pretty sure I don't actually call anyone a nonce for the whole thing, which is rare. Definitely rare. So I'm hoping they don't delve into the archives.
I could see Jim like just going through like each episode again, just finding what offensive things you said. Nah, I've got to scratch that one off. Can't send that one.
All right, I didn't have the time or the patience for that one. I just fucking did the Hail Mary, didn't I?
Just to go back to the money issue that you guys mentioned in the Club World Cup just before we move on. What do you make of the chance? So this is going to be hosted. Is this in the UAE at the moment? Or Qatar?
Yeah, I think it's Qatar, because obviously that's where the World Cup's going to be, yeah.
I found an argument. It allows rich countries like the UAE or Qatar to pay FIFA to host the competition. Thus, it helps FIFA to earn more money. What do you think of that as a
argument for? That's so outlandish. I don't know, man. I don't really believe that. I think, you know, just diluting the integrity of sport, really. And of course, that's what it's fucking about. Jesus Christ.
But what about as an argument for... that being a good thing, FIFA having more money?
I suppose. Like, what? How does that filter down to players and infrastructure and getting kids involved? I suppose it does on a level, but in the end, it's just about, like, you know, paying for the cocaine and hookers, isn't it, after the big games. That's basically what it's for. Come on, let's be real.
Yeah, this FIFA money ain't getting... It's not being seen at the grassroots levels of any country in the world, is it? Realistically, come on. It's like that Gianni Infantino, the president, what was he saying? He had some like outrageous statement that like, what was it, Flynn?
So yeah, all right. FIFA president thinks soccer can solve the world's problems using the power of racism. We need to find ways. So it was about him doing the biannual World Cup. And he thinks that would stop people trying to migrate to Europe from Africa and drowning in the Mediterranean. So he says, we need to find ways to include the whole world to give hope to Africans, so that they don't need to cross the Mediterranean in order to find a better life, or more probably death in the sea. And he thinks a bi-yearly World Cup would be just the thing for that.
Yeah, the power of racism. Spandau Ballet's lesser-known follow-up hit.
Oh, my days. What a far-fetched argument. I think that the fact that they haven't got an African team in the Club World Cup should basically condemn all this... all these ideas that Infantino has about bringing football to all corners of the globe, and basically makes a mockery of what this Club World Cup is if they're going to take that stance. So I think we should stand on the side of, yeah, let's bin that off. They tried it in 2000. They didn't like it for 5 years. And for some reason, they brought it back in, probably because they thought they could make money out of it. I just think it's a power money grab, isn't it? So we'll move on to the football talk. Obviously, Lampard in Everton. He's agreed a 2.5-year deal to become Everton's new manager, an attempt to become the first successful coach, really, under the Farhad Moshiri regime since he's been there in 2016. So what does constitute success for Lamps? I'd say, in, you know, even in the first season, what realistically, you know, would be a good season for Lampard?
Well, not getting turned over 3-1 at St. James's Park, as happened yesterday. After, you know, being a goal up as well, not the best. Was that his second game? Second game?
Yeah, they beat, who was it in the 4-1 in the FA Cup on the weekend? Was it Bournemouth or Brighton or something? So, yeah, he won his first game in the Cup, but realistically, it's the Premier League where the spotlight's going to be on him in it.
I'd say this season, for now, his aim would be to finish comfortably mid-table and get into the FA Cup final. Best case scenario, I'd say. If they beat, is it Boreham Wood that they've got next? Then they're into the quarters of the FA Cup. So I reckon realistic goal for this season, aim for something like that.
I think, obviously, he was relatively successful at Derby, weren't he, in his first sort of foray into management. Obviously, got them to a playoff final in which they lost to Aston Villa. And then that gave him the opportunity to move on to his dream job, which was coaching the team that he played over 400 appearances for. But as we know, sentiment is a scarce commodity in football. And the Chelsea job has notoriously been like one of the most difficult in the world, really, under the Abramovich era. So he's kind of had both sides of the coin, really, already. You know what I mean? He's done that sort of the route that a lot of managers do, which was go to the Championship, go to League One, learn your trade kind of thing, get some experience under your belt. And then he's jumped all the way to the other extreme. Do you know what I mean? To go and coach like a huge team like Chelsea, and also a team that he had a lot of affection for, and a team that had a lot of affection for him. Obviously, the fans love him. So obviously, he was there for what, like 18 months, wasn't really successful in any shape or form. And then it was made worse, the fact that Tuchel came in and had immediate success. Do you know what I mean? He started getting them playing really well. He didn't have to spend any money to get them playing well, which kind of made it look even worse. So, you know, how long does Lampard get? And I know I'm using negative connotations already. He's only lost one game in the Premier League so far. But that was what could be considered a six-pointer, because if they're relegation candidates, they've just lost 3-1 to Newcastle, who have gained 3 points on them. I think now Everton are only 2 points off the bottom. And although we've said before, you know, have Everton got too much quality to get relegated? They've just signed, obviously, Dele Alli for a big fee. And who's the other lad they signed?
Van der Beek
on loan from Manchester United. So two big signings that's really going to help him. But say Everton, you know, are in the relegation zone with 10 games left. Are they going to think, right, should we get someone experienced in that's, you know, been in this situation before? So what, you know, realistically, does he get to the end of the season no matter what? Does he get to the end of the season? He's got 2.5 years on his job, which is basically to the end of the season and then 2 more years. Can you realistically see him being there for that duration of the time?
Well, that length of the contract doesn't really mean anything. You know yourself, they've got the money to pay him out if it all goes tits up. So that's kind of inconsequential. They're sitting in 16th now after that loss to Newcastle. They finished 10th last season. Bearing in mind at what point in the season Lampard's taken over, we're past the halfway mark now. If he can replicate last season's result and finish 10th or top half of the table, I think that could reasonably be called a success, because then you got the summer, you know, make a few transfers, get out the deadwood, get in who you want. And then kind of give him a fair crack from there. But if he goes on a 5-6 game losing streak now, he's gone, I reckon. So to be honest with you, I think the comparison you made about Tuchel coming in and getting instant results is a fair one. But it also plays down the fact that Lampard was there for a significant amount of time and they weren't terrible. Do you know what I mean? They just weren't like smashing the league and winning Champions Leagues. And to be fair, Tuchel hasn't been as effective since he's got his own transfers in. So that's kind of, it's a moving picture there, really. I would say, based on his results at Derby and based on his stint at Chelsea, that Lampard probably good enough to manage in the Premier League. But as I say, he's 5 or 6 straight losses away from just going on the trash heap, really.
As is every Premier League manager, really. I mean, any Premier League manager that loses 6 on the trot is going to be like looking down the barrel. And obviously Everton, yeah, now only 1 point ahead of Newcastle. And 3 points ahead of Norwich, albeit with a game in hand over Norwich and Watford. But I haven't looked at Everton's next few fixtures, but I think they've got to play Leeds on the weekend, a home game against Leeds. Then they've got Southampton away. And then they've got Manchester City in the league. So obviously, they've got that Boreham Wood fixture that Liam was on about next month, start of next month. So I think, you know, realistically, does Mashiri look at that as a potential sort of addition to his job and his role as Everton manager? Should he be winning that regardless, or should he at least be trying to get to the last stages of it? Or will it be considered sort of something that'll be part of as like a bonus, do you think? Or does Mashiri really care whether Everton lift the FA Cup or not, do you think?
He should, because when's the last time Everton won anything? That would be a massive feather in every Everton cap, like all the fans, like all the board members. It's something that you can brag about at cocktail parties, isn't it? Before the hookers and the cocaine comes. But
Tim Henman rolls in.
Yeah, Tim Henman rolls in. Where the boys at? But I think, you know, all measurable success is a good thing for any club. And bearing in mind that I know Everton have done really well in the transfer market, but at the same time, they have invested a lot. They have had that revolving door of managers. They need stability, man. You know, we had that the Blues episode a few weeks ago where we were basically framing what's happened at Birmingham City as being further down the line as what's actually happening at Everton now. And you want to steady the ship as soon as you can. And if that means a mid-table finish and no cup result, then so be it. You know, you've got to steady things as best you can, I think.
Do you reckon it can be done?
Well, there's no reason to say it can't. I mean, look at, I know Newcastle's probably an anomalous comparison, but they've got Kieran Trippier in, they've got Woods in. They, you know, they've not like properly turned every, they've not got like 11 new world-class players in. They've just kind of started chipping away and churning out a few results. There's nothing to say that Everton can't do that, especially now with Van der Beek and Dele Alli, even though Dele Alli, from what I saw, was looking a bit sluggish at St. James's Park. So, yeah, there's nothing to say you can't. But, you know, at this point in the season, when the pressure's really on, it's a proper dogfight down there at the bottom end of the table. Players are scrapping for their lives, man. So that just heaps the pressure on even more.
Let's say if he does, so we've steadied the ship, we're into next season. Can you guys see him qualifying for Europe again? Like they used to. Can anyone see that happening?
I think that's a far stretch. I think he needs that. If he is going to stay for the length of that contract, I think he needs that and then another contract to realistically get them anywhere near to challenging. There's so many good teams really in the Premier League at the moment. You know, there's sort of like, you'd expect 8 or 9 teams that are going to improve and really realistically challenge for Europe every single year. And I think Everton are miles off that at the minute. And I don't think the signings have been great over the past sort of 3 or 4 years. It's been a sort of like, let's just buy high profile players and, you know, sort of fit square pegs in round holes kind of thing. Whereas I think, you know, to talk about Newcastle, the amount of money they've got, but they haven't gone about it in the same way in their recruitment process. They've hired players, and we spoke about this, and I think you mentioned this as well a couple of weeks ago, Flynn. They've brought in players that are ready as a contingency just in case they do get relegated. So they've brought in players that have experience in the Championship, like Chris Wood, like Dan Byrne, like Dwight Gale, who's been there for a while. But they've got players in that group, Jacob Murphy, that have got Championship experience as well. And obviously they've brought in that Bruno Guimaraes, who yesterday I think came on and played for 3 minutes and had better ratings than half the Everton team. So they've got players that have got quality in and around that team as well. Do you know what I mean? So I think the way they've gone about their business in January is really going to lend itself towards the end of the season. And I think they'll easily stay up. Everton, it's yet to see how they're going to perform under Lampard. But it just shows you, if you do give managers time, and like Eddie Howe has had that time now. He didn't start off like a house on fire, but they've won the last 2 games. They've just beat, you know, a team that realistically, if we're going to use our honeymoon period as an actual indicator of how a team should be performing when a manager first comes in, they've just beat a team that in theory should be beating them. Do you know what I mean? So it's a really impressive performance for Newcastle and a great result. And it doesn't look good for Lampard, really. He's really got to turn things around quickly. As Jim said, if he loses 5 or 6 games, there's a realistic possibility that he could just get moved on and they'll bring in somebody that's got experience at the sort of latter ends of the season that can come in and ensure that they don't get relegated, because that is the worst case scenario for Everton and Everton fans.
At the same time, when you frame it like that, well, how many games now for Everton? Have they got 18 games left? Is that about right? They're on 21 games played, so 17 left. That's not a lot of time, you know, at all, to start stringing wins together the way you need to. Obviously, similar to Gerrard at Villa, he's going to command a certain amount of respect from the players, and a certain amount of belief is just going to be inherent in that relationship. But also, the possibility that this is just sinking and it's leeching into the players like their very being. I didn't like the look of Dele Alli the other day, man. I only watched the highlights, but I didn't like the look of that at all, man. He's already a player that's fallen so far below his potential. And even though he's still, like, what, 24, 25, he might already be a shell of his former self. He might be a walking name on a shirt, a reputation, rather than a player that can really drag you out of a hole. I think Danny van der Beek's actually, like, a sick addition. I think, like, that kid will actually do bits in the Premier League. But you can't pin it all on one guy who's barely had a start for Manchester United in the, like, past year or so. I'm not overly familiar with him, but especially being a goal up at St. James's Park and the way they capitulated. Saying nothing about that Kieran Trippier free kick, by the way. If there was a gun to my head, I don't know about relegated, but I think they'll be definitely in that scrap in the last few games of the season.
And it's inconceivable, really, to see, to imagine Everton going down. Obviously, they're one of the mainstays in that top flight. Villa were one as well, until they got relegated in, what was it, 2016, around that time. But they're a team that have never been relegated from the Premier League, have been extremely successful for decades now. Well, I say successful, but in terms of, like, staying in the top division, that I think most teams would constitute that a success. But it is relatively inconceivable that they could get relegated. But at the end of the day, it just shows you the Premier League, like, the mighty can fall, man. Do you know what I mean? There's teams that are down there. There's a lot of good players in this league. Obviously, there's a lot of money now being pumped in. So they really, really do have to be careful. And as you said, Lampard needs to start getting results. So we'll move on to the AFCON roundup. Obviously, Flynn, you've done a fair bit of this, a fair bit of sort of watching out for this. So go through some of the things that we'll round it up, basically. So obviously, Senegal won. They beat Egypt in the final, didn't they? And their first African Cup of Nations victory. Big Alou Cisse, used to play for the Blues. Manager, he's been there since 2015. Obviously, they were runners-up in 2019 and they went one further and won it this year.
And clearly, it was his time at Blues that gave him the power he needed to get this win.
Seal this. I think so. I think so. Do you know what I mean? Just being around the good club.
Being around winners. Like, yeah, so I just wanted to go, because when the only times we've talked about the AFCON, we've talked about the silly things that have happened or the funnier things that have happened there. So I thought I'd do a quick run through some of the more interesting highlights or the more serious highlights. So I don't know if you guys caught this, but Equatorial Guinea beat the defending champs Algeria 1-0 in the group stages, ending their 35-match unbeaten streak. Algeria still went through, but big result from Equatorial Guinea there. Two interesting points from Comoros. I hadn't really heard of that country before, but Comoros, in one of their matches, they had to put their defender, Shakir Al-Haddour, he's called, they had to put him in goal against the hosts, Cameroon. The first keeper was injured, and the two backup keepers both caught COVID before the match. So the defender had to start in goal. And Cameroon were the easy favourites. Comoros still lost 2-1, but the defender managed 4 saves in total, including a huge double save at one point, getting him mad respect back at home. Also notable was he had to put a number 3 on the back of his shirt over his number 16, and he did it with mask and tape.
Boy, I thought we weren't going to talk about the silly things, Flynn. I thought this was meant to be a serious roundup of a legitimate, respected international footballing tournament, not a Sunday league fucking throw together. Do you know what I mean? It's ridiculous, isn't it?
All the listeners, check out Comoros, double save, and you'll see that double save. It was awesome. Also from Comoros, another point from them. They beat four-time champs Ghana and effectively eliminated them from Group C, which was a huge upset. Comoros went 2-0 up. Ghana captain was sent off for about 25 minutes. Ghana then came back to equalise in the second half, only for Ahmed Mogni of Comoros to score the winner in the 85th minute. Any of you guys catch that?
I saw bits and bobs of this whole tournament. The main points being Ghana, which was a huge shock. And I think their whole sort of like soccer federation were absolutely disgusted. Like, do you know what I mean? I think that was probably one of the biggest shocks, them not progressing into the group stage. I think Algeria, I think they got knocked out as well, didn't they? Who obviously won it last year. They didn't even progress for the group stages, did they? Did they get knocked out on, was it like goal difference or something in the group stages?
They were beat by Equatorial Guinea, but I think they still managed to get through.
What does that say?
I'm still looking at where Comoros is, man. Looking off the coast of Mozambique, if anyone's interested. Tiny little island, man. Of the boys.
But does that say something about the general quality of the AFCON raising? The fact that you've got teams like Comoros and Equatorial Guinea beating the sort of like mainstays of the, you know, the AFCON, you know, sort of juggernauts like Ghana, like Senegal, like Ivory Coast, that perhaps have been sort of like too dominant for too long. I think Egypt have won like 7 titles or something. They got to the final again, so they would have gone in for their 8th. Obviously, Senegal only their first title, but they've been pretty prevalent really in the world football for about 20 years now. Because obviously, Alou Cisse was part of that 2002 World Cup team that I think got to the quarters, was it, or the semis? And obviously, all the English teams started like cherry picking the players and bringing them over. I think El Hadj Diouf was part of that. He came over and Liverpool signed Alou Cisse. There was a couple more. This Yoria, Jim, you might be able to tell us.
You're right. Algeria didn't make it out of the group stages due to Equatorial Guinea and our boys Comoros.
That was very liberal use of the term juggernauts, by the way. Just put that out there.
African juggernauts. So there you go.
Yeah, relative juggernauts. Don't be chucking in African juggernauts, mate. That'll be clipped and put onto your next job interview, man. You'd be fucked.
And did Vincent Aboubakar, did he end up winning the golden boot? Because he was like 1-20 to win it at some point. I think he had like 5 or 6 goals going through the group stages. So did he end up winning the golden boot?
That's right. He got the golden boot. And in second place was his teammate, also from Cameroon, Carl Toko Ekambi.
Is it Aboubakar of Crash Bandicoot fame? Or is he a footballer in his own right?
Send that one to BBC. Oh, right. One last point from the AFCON. Gambia, you know how I love an underdog. If anyone's listened to the top of the our 50th double part episode, Gambia reached the quarterfinals, lowest ranked nation in Africa, unbeaten in the group stages by beating the 2004 champs Tunisia. Then they beat Mauritania. They drew with Mali. In the final 16, they beat Guinea, and then they were finally beaten by the hosts, Cameroon, in the quarters. Big achievement from the lowest rated African team and FIFA's 151st ranked team.
That's good going, isn't it? To be fair to him. Like, I've got no semi-racist jibes up my sleeve for this one. I actually respect that move. Rated him.
So what did we make of Mohamed Salah in the tournament? Because he didn't exactly set it on fire, did he? There was a lot of criticism, or not really criticism, but people were coming out with the sort of like, oh, he's not doing it for Egypt. He's not that player that we think he is. You know what I mean? He's no good when he hasn't got great players around him. Like, what do we think of that? Would you say, you know, should players like this, should top world-class players in their club, at their everyday club games, because he is world-class, if they don't have great sort of international tournaments, should they warrant this criticism, this sort of like, oh, he should be carrying the team?
Well, we did kind of cover this the other week, didn't we? Like, obviously, you're not going to be as effective if you're not surrounded by a higher quality of player or as high a quality of player as you are in your club season. Like, it's just standard, isn't it? Like, I think that's common sense. I did see something criticising Salah's attitude after the win, but I didn't see anything in the final. So did he have like a bad reaction to getting his silver medal or whatever it was? Because I don't think you can blame him for being less effective when he's playing for Egypt rather than Liverpool. The standard's just much lower all around him.
There was a pretty interesting photo, which I think was taken from the final against Senegal, where the referee's like handing his cards and his whistle to Salah, as if to say, like, do you want a ref? Because like he must have been just sort of like berating him about every decision. So I thought that was quite funny. So fair play to that referee.
And did you guys know that Salah didn't even get to take a penalty there in that final?
You know what? That's something I did catch with Simon Jordan and what's his name? This Scottish guy on TalkSport. They were saying that, well, a caller came in and spoke about this, but they commented on it. They said that he volunteered to take the fifth penalty and they criticized him on the basis that that was potentially an ego move. And Danny Murphy was in the studio saying that the most effective penalty positions are first and fourth. But rarely are you going to... Rarely is a penalty shootout over by the third. So I was going to actually ask Bissett about this. I'm glad you reminded me about that, to be fair. So is there any credence to that argument? Or is Salah being egotistical? Or is this just retrospective, like kicking him while he's down, type of vibe?
It's dependent on who decides who the penalty takers are, whether the coach... has a predetermined penalty taker list, you know. So usually you know, I think in the game before, was it Cameroon? They beat on penalties. They beat the previous, I think in the semi-final, I think they won on penalties or the quarters. I think Salah was fifth to take the penalty in that shootout as well. So I would assume that the coach is probably stuck by the same list of penalty takers. But it's interesting what you said about what Danny Mills was saying on TalkSport. I think, yeah, the most important positions are first and fourth, because fourth is usually the decider. That's usually where it can tilt a team into either being in the lead or being behind. And obviously, it's a massive mental sort of boost if you can go into that fifth penalty being in the lead. And obviously, being first as well, if you get your head, your noses in front, in terms of the psychology of a penalty shootout, that's massive. And I think they have actually done like a load of research. I say loads of research. They've just collected data on teams that have started with the first penalty kick. I can't remember what it was. It was like there's definitely a big difference in teams that go on to win when they score their first penalty. So teams that shoot first end up sort of winning. I think it's over sort of might be 58, 59% of the time. So there's a massive advantage if you can put your best penalty taker in that first position. Then usually that will lead you to being successful. But it's the same thing with Cristiano Ronaldo. I think he used to take penalties fifth for Portugal. I think a similar situation happened to him in a tournament where Portugal went out and he didn't get to take his penalty. So I don't know. If I've got a penalty taker of or a player of that quality, I'm putting him either first or fourth.
They intimated that perhaps Salah, being the influential player that he is for Egypt, maybe he had more of a say in where he ended up in the penalty taking lineup than perhaps the manager did. Now, obviously, that's all speculation, but I can envisage players going for that glory moment. I can definitely imagine Cristiano Ronaldo saying, "I'm taking the last one because I want that moment." Perhaps Salah's doing that. I couldn't say for certain, but it rings true to a certain extent, especially when you marry that with the semi-abuse that Salah may have been giving the referee. A bit of egotism in there, but all great players have it. So I'm not really criticising him on that level.
It's funny that you mentioned Ronaldo. So Jamie Carragher has said this about Mo Salah. He says, "This is why your best penalty taker should never go fifth. Mo Salah not taking a penalty for Egypt in a shootout in a final is madness. It also happened to Ronaldo years ago against Portugal and Spain."
Yeah,
so there you go. Locked it off,
the Euros, isn't it? Yeah, it must have been. As you say, and it is madness, really. You should put your best penalty taker first. I think always try and get on the front foot in a penalty shootout. Psychologically, it's just such a huge boost if you can. So I don't think he took a penalty in that one, and he didn't take a penalty in the final because they were already out by it. So yeah, very, very interesting. But I think, yeah, if you got a player of that quality on the pitch, get him to take the first penalty.
Well, they had three penalty shootouts throughout the whole tournament, I think. So I don't know what Egypt were doing, playing for the draw, or whether they were just set up defensively. I didn't watch enough of it, to be honest, but that was kind of like, how do you go to penalties that many times? Do you know what I mean? So, and then you think you'd like perfect the recipe, really, by the time you get to the final. But obviously, football's a funny game on the biggest stage. And I use that term relatively as well, the biggest stage.
It's quite clear that Jim doesn't give any respect to the AFCON. Maybe one day he'll put some respect on the AFCON's name.
Or just Africa.
Just Africa in general. Like.
No. I want to go to Kenya, man. India don't want to go, but I actually want to go. So it's nothing against Africa in general, but I just think that you can't elevate the legitimacy of a tournament just based on inclusion. I think there are definite levels to everything. And I think the African Cup of Nations is quite low down compared to not just the Euros, but even like, you know, the Copa America and stuff like that. There's just an objective difference in standard of play. That's all. I know I'm being a bit like facetious when I say things like, I ain't got a problem with it. I want them to do better because that will make the World Cup better. And the higher the overall competition is, the better it is for us as spectators. So,
and somebody, I saw an interesting argument on social media. They were saying that perhaps the winners of each of these sort of confederations, so the Euros, the AFCON, the Copa Americas, they should get an automatic place to the World Cup. And I thought that is a pretty fair argument, to be fair. And it'd give a little bit more incentive for the teams that are there. Obviously, because the World Cup is the biggest stage, every team wants to play in the World Cup. So if you sort of gave the different confederations each a sort of place into the World Cup, I think that would be better than having these sort of teams that in these qualifying processes that sometimes sneak through. I think that would be a fair way to do it. And then perhaps have the qualifying process outside of that initial seven. They get, obviously, it'd be seven plus whoever's hosting it, eight. I don't know. I thought that was a fair argument.
That would definitely be better than having, like you say, the odd fucking dark horse getting in there on some qualification-based anomaly. Yeah, for sure. And it would also give more legitimacy to the tournament, you know. So, yeah, that would be a good way to go. To be fair, I assume that's the way it worked anyway, but hopefully they change it.
I thought you were going to say they just put each winner into, like, this mini tournament to get a true World Cup, true
what,
King of the World.
A bit like the Club World Cup.
A bit like the Club World Cup.
Bring back the Club World Cup. Yeah. It's the best tournament in history, man.
Who said that was a bad idea? No one. Who was criticising that? I don't know. Anyway, let's move on to the hand egg. We'll talk about the greatest sports person alive and his retirement first, because we didn't get a chance to talk about that last week, obviously. But we'll have a little word on Tom Brady and just sort of like, you know, revel in his greatness, like for inshallah. Is that right, Flynn? For a few moments.
No, we're saying. No.
Oh, you weren't inshallah. I thought you were both inshallah. I thought you were like inshallah.
Inshallah.
For those obviously not being able to see the video, I was chatting away there and going full all in on Tom Brady's greatness. And the lads were saying like, hold up with their arms. And I thought they were both inshallah and Tom Brady, but clearly not. Anyway, so I don't know how much of that's caught, but I am
inshallah in my heart.
But yeah, definitely the greatest American football player to ever step on the field. But his retirement announcement was quite interesting. He thanked just about everybody apart from anyone to do with the Patriots organization. I want to get your two opinion on this. Obviously, no Robert Kraft, no Bill Belichick, obviously the coach and the owner that was so successful with him along that journey in New England for 19 years. And it leads me to believe, and the sort of, you know, sporting world in general, and that there's a lot more to him leaving New England when he did than we initially assumed 2 years ago. So perhaps he wanted to stay there, finish his career in New England, but there were certain things that happened behind doors. So what? Let's just speculate, because I haven't read anything about this. I haven't read any sort of concrete evidence as to why Tom Brady wanted to leave and move on to Tampa, but what sort of things could have happened? Let's have a little speculation round.
I lost the last bit of what you said then. I think you said a little scratch around. Is that what you said?
Let's have a little scratch around. Yeah, yeah. I said a little speculation round, but that scratch around works just as well.
What's the official story about him moving, first of all?
The official story was kind of like they just didn't renew his contract, didn't it? So they didn't sign him on for another year or two or whatever it was. And then he moved to Tampa. And I think it was the old classic, oh, I just want to sort of go somewhere, you know, a sort of fresh surroundings and sort of a new challenge. You know, they'll always give this spiel, won't they, players? So that's, I think that was kind of the official statement from both him and the club. But it quite clearly seems like there has been something behind closed doors, because you'd think if you retire and you spent 19 years at a team, won seven championships, basically become the greatest quarterback the sport's ever seen, for you not to initially recognize the owner of that team and the coach that you were so successful with for that period, I feel like there must be some sort of sour eggs.
Well, if Tom Brady has even an inkling of the personality traits that Michael Jordan has, I imagine he would have taken his contract not being renewed very, very personally. So if, let's just say, like, or you've just listed all of his accolades there. He's proven that he's deserved to be keeping on. And they've made the decision based on a number, not on his performances, but the fact that he's getting into his 40s as a reason not to renew his contract. Never mind, he's the cornerstone of this football team for the better part of 2 decades. They've just lowered him off. I could imagine that would really hurt someone's feelings if they're the poster child for a particular team, especially when you're still performing. And especially when you go to a different team who are little fancied to do anything and you replicate that feat with one of your top boys next year. How would you feel about that? I'd be thinking, fuck the Patriots if I was Tom Brady, for real.
The whole story's not adding up to me at all. You've been with them for 19 years. You've got all these accolades with them, and then they just don't renew your contract. I don't see it. Even if he is getting older, they see him train. They know what he can do. There's something not right. And part of me is thinking money. Did he demand too much? But then how much is too much for a player like that? So it's not adding up. Did he ask for some like astronomical amount that they just couldn't afford? I don't know.
It's cutthroat though, isn't it? Football, like, you got to get to the point where I imagine the salary would have been a factor, and they've coupled that with the factor of his age, and they think, is it worth it? Should we just get involved in the draft or trade someone up, and we can have the next generation? We've got the coaching staff involved. We've got the team legacy, all this kind of shit, overlooking the fact that that team legacy is largely built around Tom Brady and how good he is. NFL, from what I can gather, it's not like football or basketball or anything like that, because of the way the game like plays out, because it's so much stop start and there's so many specific sequences of play. He's more important than, say, like, I don't know, like a Paul Scholes or someone might have been back in the day for United. He gets the ball every time, and he gets an opportunity to do something meaningful with the ball every time. No matter if he's playing badly or not, the ball is still going to come to him. So he's going to be at the center of the game, regardless if he's playing. Now, whether they thought he couldn't hack it anymore, maybe he's carrying a few injuries. Maybe they did see something in training. They're like, nah, fuck it, he's past it. But he went on to tamper and to prove him wrong. I don't know, man. It was a definite miscalculation on the Patriots' part anyway. Because, you know, I'd be thinking that same thing. I gave you 20 years of my life, you fucking cunt. You can't keep me on the payroll for another 2 years. I'd definitely be thinking that way, man. I rate Tom Brady even more now.
Yeah, and it was obviously strictly a business decision, wasn't it? Because it couldn't have been a sentimental decision, because they just would have paid him, man, for what he's brought in terms of success to that franchise. And I think NFL, as you said, it is cutthroat. It's quite unique in terms of the way it goes about its contractual obligations with players, and sort of the way it's structured its finances, really. Obviously, they have the cap space that they have to adhere to, same as baseball does, and same as basketball does. They've got a similar system in terms of the draft picks and stuff like that. And we're going to get onto something called tanking, which is kind of something that we don't hear about in sports outside of America, because there's no need to do it, but losing to get draft picks. And, you know, that's kind of separate. We're going to talk about that later. But I think there is situations in baseball and basketball. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but I've definitely saw examples where they sort of pay players for life. Do you know what I mean? They'll give them like lifetime contracts. And it's kind of like, all right, you've given us a great service to the team. Like, you've brought us all this success. I think then maybe the Yankees did it with Derek Jeter. But they basically give you like a lifetime contract and say, like, look, you've been so successful with us. Like, this is the least we can do. And obviously, the football isn't like that. And the Patriots obviously dropped a massive bollock, as Jin alluded to, like, because he went in the following year, won a Super Bowl with a brand new team, brand new coach and stuff. And I think that kind of just cemented his greatness, really.
Well, maybe they offered him like an ambassadorial role or something like that, where they're like, look, we'll give you a bit of dough, but you're not starting. And maybe Tom Brady was like, listen, I'm starting. I'm good enough. I've been good enough this whole time. And maybe they clashed heads, or maybe they just clashed on that level, you know, because I can see ego coming into the boardroom just as much as it comes onto the pitch in that way. So maybe that's what happened. Maybe they had a disagreement over his future role with the Patriots. I don't know, man.
There's a good chance of that. I think they brought in Mac Jones obviously in the draft. So they must have been already been looking at a quarterback. Maybe they wanted to come in and sort of be a mentor for Mac Jones. And he was like, you what? I can still go and win a Super Bowl. And they were like, Tom, I'm not sure. You've won seven, you know, you've won seven in your career or six in your career. Are you really sure you can go and win another one? And he was probably like, yeah, fucking watch me.
Yeah. Tom, why don't you come and take a seat? He's like, nah, I'll fucking stand, you pricks.
How much time was there between his last Super Bowl win with the Patriots and them not renewing the contract? Was that a long time or a short time?
The Patriots won in 2017. Did they win in 20? Who won it the year before Tampa? Kansas City won it the year before that. I think they did. I think it was only like 3 or 4 years. They definitely won it in 2017. I think they might have won another one after that, maybe. Might have been 2019. I think maybe they won it. So it wasn't long, man. He was clearly like could still, you know, do the business like for any team in the league, and he proved it. So big up to him. He's going to go down as like the greatest player of all time, not just in his sport, but he will be considered like one of the greatest sports people of all time, behind mankind. So, you know,
in a Brady-less Super Bowl, we've got the Bengalis versus the Rams. What do you reckon?
Yeah, and it's not really a sexy matchup, to be honest. But obviously, people from Cincinnati and LA will beg to disagree. But Bengals, and Flynn's gonna love this, and we might get him interested in watching it this year. Hopefully, he's probably watched a few before anyway. But they were huge outsiders, the Cincinnati Bengals. And they'll bid to win their first ever league championship. So you got to love this story. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be the team that everybody wants to win, because LA have been sort of formulated. They're one of these franchise teams. So they were St. Louis Rams. They were somewhere else before. I think this is their like third sort of city that the Rams franchise have been in, which is just bizarre to like sort of, you know, non-Americans really, in terms of like teams going elsewhere, kind of like Milton Keynes did. But they, ironically, the Rams will be the away team in their own stadium. So this is the way the draws panned out. So unless I'm mistaken, they'll be using the away dressing rooms, which could add a bit of a psychological conundrum amidst the fine margins of elite level sport. I see Jim shaking his head.
What a load of bollocks, man. How? Why would you do that? What? That's just one of the few things that it's not a big deal, obviously. So it's the nature of the game itself is the reason why I don't actually watch it. But little things like that really irritate me. Why would you have it at one of their stadiums and have them in the away dressing room? Why? Why have the fucking home team on the right hand side of the screen? Obviously, this is just my predilection for Premier League games and all that. But I'm just saying, it fucking irritates me.
Nah, I feel you. But they decide either a year in advance or maybe even 2 years in advance where the final was going to be. So it was kind of like that wasn't predicted. It wasn't like, oh, they said, oh, like, who's going to be in the final? All right, we'll make you the home team and then put you in the away team dressing room. But it's just the way it's what worked out. But I do feel what you're saying. It does annoy me the way they reverse the team names on the screen, though. That's never made any sense to me. But I think the Bengals, they'll have absolutely nothing to lose. Obviously, they find themselves in a position where virtually everyone has doubted them. They were like 21-3 down to Pat Mahomes' Chiefs in the AFC Championship game. Joe Burrow is going to be this unlikely hero. What is it? It might be second season in the league. So no one really expected him to be in this position. They've really got a stout defense that managed to hold one of the best quarterbacks in the league in Mahomes and one of the most innovative tactical minds in charge of the offense in Andy Reid to just 3 points in that second half, which led them to win the game in overtime with a field goal. So certainly an underdog. I think the money's going on Rams as well. So a lot of people are thinking, right, you know, sort of their team experience is going to be the one. Obviously, Matthew Stafford is his first appearance in a Super Bowl as well. With him only winning, I think, 3 playoff games, same as Joe Burrow. They both had never been in a playoff game prior to the start of the season. So both inexperienced quarterbacks. So it's kind of like the absolute like polar opposite of Tom Brady being in there. Do you know what I mean?
Sounds fun. You got the absolute scrags coming off after Brady leaves. Not feeling this, mate. I was listening to a podcast called The Fighter vs. The Writer, and Chris Weidman was on there from the UFC. And he said, they were talking about the Super Bowl. Which one of these teams lost to the Jets in the regular season. I think he was talking about the Bengals, man.
I think the Bengals did, yeah.
And aren't the Jets like fucking atrocious, like?
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember the game specifically, but yeah, that kind of makes sense. That might have been the day Mike White for the Jets like had an unbelievable game, and like people were thinking he was like the next Tom Brady kind of thing. He just went off and just like, I think he scored like 5 touchdowns or something, and like Jets were like hailing him as like the Messiah. And then like 2 games later, he was benched because he was fucking terrible. Like he just had this one-off mad game. Like where he just, yeah, it was the Bengals. Yeah, I remember it now. So yeah, I think NFL can be a little bit like that. Just throw up some absolutely balmy results. But the players to watch out for in this Super Bowl will certainly be wide receiver Cooper Kupp for the Rams, along with Odell Beckham Jr., who's really grown into that wide receiver two slot in LA. And obviously, they sort of brought in players that were, they've been ready made for the Super Bowl. The Rams, they you know, they brought in Von Miller on the defense in the sort of like in the trade window. So they kind of spent big in a way. Do you know what I mean? They're kind of going to be the sort of Man City or the Chelsea of this final. Obviously, they got Tyler Higbee, who suffered an injury, who's going to be back in the squad, so he's going to be one to look out for. And then Bengals, they'll have quarterback Joe Burrow. And he'll be looking to sort of continue his burgeoning relationship with LSU teammate Jamar Chase, who's having a remarkable season. And he'll also have T. Higgins in the air and Joe Mixon on the ground to sort of strike a balanced offense. And I think that will be important if they want to win their first ever championship.
So how excited are you about this? The two Scrags coming together. What do you think is going to happen? How do you see it playing out? Like, how do you see it going? What Bissett's bets odds are you going to be giving to Tino? Actually, this might be the one and only sport in existence that Tino doesn't want to bet on. So what would you give to Ben Pritchard and Pizzy?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can bait Tino into a bet. I even tried to bait him into having a bet on the Blues earlier by giving him 9-1 on the Blues, which was a massive, massive price. But there, I went to Bournemouth, but I couldn't get any bites out of him today. But I would say I think it's gonna be a close one. I think it's not gonna be really high scoring. I think it's my prediction's 24-21 to the Rams. I think it will be close. I think it'll probably go down to the wire. Maybe Rams get a couple of touchdowns up and then Bengals get back into it. But I think it will go down to the fourth quarter. I think both teams will still be in it for the win. But I think Rams will probably edge it in the end. And any odds? Yeah. So I don't know, man. Let's see if Tommy Howes or Ben Pritchard fancy a little go on the Bisbets.
I was going to say, Tommy, sorry for leaving you out there, Tommy. You gave us good feedback on the last few podcasts, mate. Yeah, definitely take Bisbets bets to the cleaners, man.
Put everything on the Bengals. I've got a feeling they're going to do it. I'm liking the underdog story. I'm hyped for this. When's it on?
It'll be, I think it's 11:30 UK time on Sunday. So hopefully you ain't got work on Monday, because that'll be like, what, midnight for you, isn't it?
It'd be, yeah, an hour later, but it's worth a watch. So that sounds brilliant.
Is it worth staying up for the Super Bowl halftime?
For the halftime?
Yeah, the halftime show.
Fallout Boy and Mariah Carey?
Let's have a look.
Is a decrepit Janet Jackson going to get a nipple out again?
Eminem, Kendrick Lamar, Snoop Dogg. It's worth staying up just for that, mate.
That might be all right. Yeah, I might tune in. I might just watch the halftime show and load the game.
All right. Should we do the 5 things?
Yep.
All right, so number one, crime fiction novelist Val McDermid has said that she would withdraw her support and sponsorship of Raith Rovers Football Club in the wake of their signing David Goodwillie from Clyde FC. So, like, this geezer was ruled to be a rapist and ordered to pay damages in a civil case in 2017. However, he never faced a criminal trial over the rape accusation after prosecutors said there was not enough evidence. And obviously with what we've had with Mason Greenwood recently, and then obviously there was a big case with Ched Evans a few years ago when he was playing for Sheffield United. He was later sort of not exonerated, but I think there was evidence that came out that sort of said that maybe she might have been lying. But where do you two, I want to get Flynn's opinion on this first. And obviously, do you think the owners have weighed up the consequences and thought, you know, the fact he's a proven goal scorer at this level, does that outweigh the bad sort of PR they will receive by signing him?
What's the facts of the matter here? So he was found to be a rapist or guilty of rape. What's the situation here?
So he was charged and ordered to pay damages in his civil case.
Okay. Well, yeah, I wouldn't have him on my team. Do you know what I mean? Even if he was amazing.
Not even if he's 40 goals a season. Nah,
40 goals a season, no chance. Okay, so it's not even the company man vibe coming out. Like, yeah, you're going to lose sponsors, that sort of thing. It's a moral sort of thing. Something just morally sits a bit wrong with me there. But then that's just me. That's just me. But that's just me, you know. Company man says, get rid of him. Bad for sponsorship. Moral Liam says, yeah, that's pretty. Sounds like a pretty horrible guy to have around. But then, Glory Hunter Liam wants the goals. So, two out of three says get rid of him. I say,
what do you? I just can't get over the irony of someone called Goodwillie being a rapist.
Yeah, so I'm just reading up on it now. So it was the first case of its kind in Scotland. I'm not sure how that worked out. But the judge ruled that both him and teammate Robertson, they had committed rape, ordered them to pay $100,000 in compensation. The civil case was judged on the balance of probabilities and did not need corroboration of evidence, unlike in a Scottish criminal case. So I'm not sure exactly how that works, but, I think... The appeal was upheld. So appeal judges at the Court of Session upheld the ruling against Goodwillie and Robertson. They avoided paying any of the compensation due to declaring bankruptcy. So there's another little twist to the story. So they didn't end up even paying any of the compensation, if I'm reading that correctly.
That sounds like a guy who's got a shit hot solicitor or a barrister, and he's just worked his way through every loophole possible, man. I mean, think about it. Even $100,000's compensation for your dignity, that's not a lot of money. You know, if it happened, obviously we don't know, we're speculating to a certain extent, but that's some fucking peanuts in it, really, if he actually raped someone. And then he didn't even have to pay it because, oh, he got no money, poor me. But now back in League One, banging in goals for jokes. It's unsavory, man. It is unsavory for sure.
Well, a more light-hearted one then. So Roberto Carlos reportedly signed with a Shropshire Sunday League side. So banana kicks in the stench of pubs, I'm all for it. The 48-year-old former fullback, who I swear had the hardest shot in world football at one point, will appear as a substitute in a game this month after they acquired his services in a transfer raffle on eBay, which I did not know existed. Apparently, the club just had to pay £5 to enter a raffle for a chance to have a pro sign for your team. And they got landed with Roberto Carlos, who must be short of a few quid.
Now, I think he does all right. You know, I remember when we were in Los Angeles for the Fury fight, his poster was everywhere because he was running soccer camps out there. So obviously he's still like a viable commercial entity on that kind of level. Maybe he is hard up. I don't know. Maybe he's got the old fake Peruvian passport like Ronaldinho. Maybe he's got some... Maybe he's got some solicitor's bills to pay himself, like Goodwillie. But yeah, I don't know. It's a nice little anomaly, this, isn't it? Roberto Carlos for a fiver in a raffle. I mean, well, wouldn't you? Sick story, really.
And I reckon their regular left back's probably not going to get game, is he? I don't know. He's probably not going to get many minutes during that one game that Roberto Carlos gets to play.
Oh, why do you think that, man? Weird.
All right, number three, Emma Raducanu is one of six British nominees for the 2022 Larius World Sports Awards, which is an annual award ceremony honouring individuals and teams from the world of sports, along with sporting achievements throughout the year. She'll be entered into the Breakthrough of the Year award, along with Neeraj Chopra, who became India's first ever athletics gold medal winner, tennis player Daniil Medvedev, Spanish football player Pedri, and Yulimar Rojas, and Ariane Titmus in athletics and swimming, respectively. I'll tell you why I've got a bit of an issue with this. If she does win this award, she'll now have one more award for her achievements than her actual achievements within the sport. And like, if she wins this, obviously coupled with a BBC Sports Personality of the Year award, which basically needs name changing, but that's another story. But since her incredible feat of winning the US Open in September, she's got beating the BNP Paribas in the round of 64, beating the Transylvanian Open in the quarterfinal to Count Dracula, beating the Upper Austria Ladies Linz to 86th in the world, beating the Sydney Tennis Classic in the round of 32 and beating the Australian Open in the round of 64 to 74th in the world. So if my point hasn't hit home, maybe we're a tad too quick to laud praise on our young athletes. And perhaps this is endemic to the culture of youth today. What do you think, Jim?
Well, it seems that her results following the US Open upset are more reflective of her ranking going into that tournament. You can't really blame sponsors and other commercial entities who attach themselves to athletes for attaching themselves to her, because we spoke about this loads of times. She's young, she's good looking, she's personable, she's British after a sense. She's also a lot multi-ethnic. She ticks a lot of boxes, man. Now, if I was an athletic company or a fashion company or anything like that, I would want to get in on the ground floor. I would want to secure a contract. I would want to be associated with her just in case she goes on to smash it. Now, 9 out of 10 players don't achieve long-term greatness. You know, she's still a young girl. She's in between trainers, as we discussed in previous episodes. There's nothing to say that she can't replicate that Grand Slam win, but it's a big ask, isn't it? You know, going to the French Open, the Australian Open, the US Open, Wimbledon, and replicating success there. Very few players do that. So I think she's got a long road ahead, but I also agree with you that she was being lauded as, oh, this is the next bit. This is the next best thing. Just watch her, just watch her. And it's a lot more complicated than that when you're talking at the highest level of sports.
And obviously it's not even been a year since she's had that first success, but already we've started to see signs that perhaps she can't replicate that success that she had. I mean, there's a good chance that that might be her only ever major win. I mean, it's conceivable, isn't it, that she might never win a major again. But that's not to say that she's not going to, and maybe we are jumping on the sort of like, all right, she's going to do nothing else. Maybe there's been too much praise been heaped on too early. But from as a commercial venture, obviously, yeah, like you said, if you were in a company and you want her face to be on the front page of your magazine, or you want her to be selling your product for you, basically, isn't it? But how long does that last? Like, how long in between majors can you have, you know, to make sure that success continues? Because she's been touted as being like the first billionaire woman sports person, you know, projectively in the future. So like, how long does that last? When does her next major need to come, or her next, you know, sort of tournament win then to come? Does it need to come in the next 2 years, would you say?
Well, I remember you saying that billionaire projection. I just thought, fucking hell, it's a bit early for all that, isn't it? You know, only the elite of the elite get anywhere near that level. So to say that after one Grand Slam win is pure hyperbole, but that just demonstrates the furore that was around her, the excitement that was around her. They were like, we've got one, we've caught lightning in a bottle. Look, 9.5 times out of 10, it doesn't work out like that. As to your question, if she goes, how old is she now? Still 18, 19? She's still a kid, isn't she? So I don't know what the details of her contracts are, but if she wins the Australian Open in 2 years' time, I would say that's not worlds away from achieving the potential she might have eventually reached had she not had that shock win in the US Open. This is a long game, you know. What if she finds the right coach? What if she finds a groove? What if she, you know, doesn't suffer any injuries? What if her main competitors go through difficulties? There's a lot of moving parts to it, man. I would say like the next 2 or 3 years are going to be very telling. I wouldn't be thinking she's got to win a Grand Slam in the next 6 months or she's finished. Definitely not, man. There's a long road ahead for her.
And if the way Naomi Osaka seems to have fell off the face of the earth commercially is anything to go by, then she's not going to have that much longer, and she needs to be successful consistently. You know what I mean? If that's anything to go by.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, not everyone can be Venus and Serena Williams. Not everyone can be Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic. These are the top 0.05%. So we're just going to have to wait and see. But definitely, everyone jumped on that shit way too quickly. And you can't discount the commercial appeal that she has. As I said, good looking, personable, all that good stuff. And it all got that sort of stuff mingles or gets intermingled with actual performance and results on the court, which is a shame, really, but that's just the way it is.
Might be worth mentioning, the award that we're talking about is Breakthrough of the Year. And I'd find it kind of hard to argue against her being one of the breakthroughs of the year. What do you reckon there? And I mean, solely based on sporting prowess as well. Yeah, that's came out of nowhere and smashed the tournament. I think this one, the sports personality one, I'm on the fence a bit. But this one, this one makes sense to me, I'd say.
Oh, I said about the sports personality, I do think the name of that should be changed. But I'd have no argument with her winning this award. I'd have the what I would be uncomfortable with would be the fact that she's won these two awards whilst only winning one actual award in her competition. So it's kind of like, I feel like there's too much praise being put on sort of athletes at that age. It's kind of like, because that could just be an anomaly. We could be looking back on 10 years and that could be the only win of her career. Because I imagine this happened a lot of times in various sports. So I just think, I just think we need to be careful because we could be doing a more harm than good. But I say the media could be doing more harm than good. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens with her in the future, I suppose. But number four, the US men's national team played their World Cup qualifier against Honduras in biblical conditions at Allianz Field in Minnesota last week. The temperature was as low as minus 18 degrees Celsius during the game, but it still drew a capacity crowd. And I would say to you, is this not dangerously cold to be playing a footy match, or did they want to put off the Hondurans that badly? Craig Burley, who seems to commend some respect in the footballing world over here, was absolutely fuming. What do you think of this?
Well, the only time I've been in conditions, even approaching that, was in Norway, but I used to get up early to go to work. And sometimes I'd turn on the delivery van and the thing would read minus 15 and it was fucking cold. Like I'd be fully like skinnies on underneath my work uniform, full jacket, hat, gloves upon gloves. And you'd be shaking. Like it gets to your bones, man. I can't imagine doing anything sporting in that environment. You know, even at like minus 8, sometimes I'd be walking the dog thinking, fucking hell, I'm not going to make it. Do you know what I mean? It's a lap around the block. I don't know how you'd be playing in shorts and t-shirts doing this, man. Fuck that.
Absolutely raving on the Hondurans as well, because they used to, what I would imagine in Honduras is probably averaging, I don't know, 30 degrees for the year or whatever. I imagine if in South America at that point, it probably would have been around that temperature. And they got to come over here and play in that minus 18 when they could have just moved it to Florida and played in similar conditions. Not really sure about that. I feel like it was a bit of a tactical ploy from the US Soccer Federation there.
Is there no laws against like minimum, maximum temperatures during games or anything like that?
Fucking the World Cup's in Qatar, mate. They're going to be melting on the fucking AstroTurf over there. They don't give a shit, man.
But well, they did move it to the winter for that. Was that due to there being a law for players playing in conditions that are too hot or not?
Yeah, you can't have footballers playing in 40 degree heat, can you? Because you'd be having, oh, actually, they should have done that. It wouldn't might have masked all the heart attacks or the cardiac arrests that have been happening. Do you know what I mean? They've actually dropped a bollock there. They should have been in accordance with with all the medical companies. But yeah, you'd assume so, wouldn't you? You'd assume FIFA would have some kind of like rule about like minus temperatures as they do like hot temperatures, because obviously I think if a game's over 30 degrees they legally have to have these intermittent water breaks or whatever. But it just makes no sense to me. They should have just moved it. I have no idea why they didn't. They ended up winning 3-0. I think three players, I don't know if they were Hondurans or not, went off with hypothermia during the game or something crazy like that, I read afterwards. So it was just dangerous, to be honest, on the side of the US Soccer Federation. Right. And lastly, number five, ex-Cleveland Browns coach Hugh Jackson. This is something we've done about earlier. Spoke out about clauses in his contract, which, while at the franchise, incentivized losing during his 2.5 year stint, where he went 3-36-1 as head coach, 3 losses, 36 wins and a draw. Jackson said that the end of the season bonuses he received from the Browns as part of a plan to lose in the 2016 and 2017 seasons maxed out at $750,000. Supposedly, this was part of a 4-year plan, which involved the franchise essentially tanking, which is a thing in American sports, in order to stock up on lucrative draft picks to eventually make them a stronger team in the future. But Jackson claimed he never knew he was part of a clear-out plan until a month and a half into his tenure as head coach, when he started to get bonus payments of up to $100,000 a time, even though the team only won one game in his first two seasons coach. He didn't come out about it while he was there, when he was getting $100,000 in his pocket, though, did he?
Yeah, basically, Hugh Jackman and the lads. He wasn't fucking like, you'd know, wouldn't you? You would absolutely know. I've got a dog shit record of 3-36-1. Or even if you're like, say, if you go 1-10, right? Oh, that's a lovely bonus I've just got in the mail. I'm just going to shut the fuck up about that and just carry on losing. Like, surely alarm bells are ringing. Of course, he knew what the fuck was going on. Come on, man.
Of course
he Shame did. On Wolverine, man.
So he was, what's the news here? He was scamming everyone for a little while and he's not anymore. And now he's blowing the whistle. Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, it does seem a little bit like that, doesn't it? He's trying to get compensation from the compensation that he already got for losing, deliberately losing football games. Do you know what I mean? But it's quite an interesting dynamic, really, with American sports, is because like there's a certain level of lucrativeness, really, when it comes to getting that first draft pick in, definitely in basketball and the NFL, which is more put on. Maybe it's the same in baseball. I'm not really sure about that. But that first pick can be the difference between you having, like, Tom Brady. Well, I say Tom Brady level success. He was like 199th pick. But by and large, they say that the first pick could be a great quarterback, great franchise quarterback that could give you 10 plus years of success. So that first round pick, that first pick of the draft, can be very enticing to teams. A lot of times it doesn't work out. There's been loads of like first round picks that have flopped it, especially quarterbacks. But there is teams, and then I think the 76ers did it a few years ago. Like it was clear that they were deliberately losing games or not trying to win games, you know what I mean? So that they could get like very, very good draft picks. And that's just kind of like a byproduct of the draft system.
Well, this is why I'm so cynical when it comes to sports, because the draft system on the surface is an egalitarian system. But look at what these fuckers are doing. Deliberately losing so they can manufacture getting the number one draft pick over a 4-year plan. That's some fucking Darth Vader shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not just a one-off, oh yeah, we'll play shit for a bit, then we'll sort. No, this is a long-term, let's stagnate this. Let's absolutely, like, let's just pretend we're getting shit steadily so we can continue. Do you know what I mean? And this fucking Hugh Jackman, man, he's got a lot to answer for.
And we can absolutely rip our fans off in the process, do you know what I mean? They can pay exactly the same price as any other team that are winning, like, consistently in the division. Like, you're only going to see one win in 2 years, but we'll still charge like $80 a ticket and charge you $12 for a hamburger.
I bet your ticket prices went up in that period.
Wouldn't be surprised.
Fuckers, man.
So I've got a question here. So the idea I'm getting is what the team who does worst in the league gets first draft pick. But what exactly does that mean? You get to pick a bunch of players or you get to pick one guy, or how does it work?
Well, if you've been shit for 4 years, you'll have stocked up on some pretty good draft picks. So that will give you the opportunity to, in theory, take the best player out of college. So if there's like a star quarterback for, like, I don't know, Alabama, or, you know, like a great running back that's coming out of whatever college team, Clemson or whatever, you would get the opportunity to get those before anybody else. That's how the sort of like draft pick works. And you can also use these draft picks to use in trades. So if you wanted to get, in theory, if you wanted to get Tom Brady when he was at the height of his powers, like, you could use, say, 2 round one draft picks to entice him away from whatever, from the Patriots or where he was. So it kind of like, it's kind of like trade capital. Do you know what I mean? Then it is used like that. It's kind of like capital that they can use to try and get good players to their franchise. And doing it over 4 years would stock up a lot of that capital. So in theory, like, they should be, Cleveland Browns should be a team that's in contention, like, around about now, but they're kind of not really. You know, they're kind of still kind of like a middling team, but they're not as horrendous as they were during that period, that's for sure.
And how many draft picks on average do you get after having a really bad season?
You'll get awarded the first in the draft. So if you're the worst team, which I think Jacksonville Jags were until the end of the season, but then that was quite interesting. They beat, who was it, the Colts on the last game of the season, who were really expected to win. And they'd done themselves out of the top pick in the draft, I believe. And then I think it's gone to, might have gone to Jets now. So there's kind of like, I guess that'll be, the naysayers will be like, no, that proves that the system works, man. They went to the last game of the season. They still put in a good performance and beat Colts. So they didn't get the top draft pick. But I feel like, there's no saying that the geezer you're going to get in the first pick is going to be the best player in the league anyway. you know what I mean? It just shows you, like, 199th pick, like Tom Brady, best player in the game we're probably ever going to see. And he was like 200 picks down. But yeah, is that it? All right, so should we move on to the combat sports?
Yeah, let's move on to the combat sports. We'll start with the boxing from last weekend and how I haven't picked a winner since Norm. I've repeatedly put it out there about how I thought Liam Williams was just a better fighter than Eubank Jr. How all Eubank has is a good engine, a decent chin, and an amazing last name. And the most galling thing about Eubank, not only winning, but dominating this fight, is that I still believe all those things. I've been trying to wrap my head around it ever since. So Chris Eubank Jr., son of the legend, he put Liam Williams down 3 times in the first 4 rounds of their middleweight contest, mostly with well-timed jabs as Williams was rushing in. From a points perspective, the fight was over from then and Williams had to chase the fight and realistically had to chase the knockout. Now, all Eubank had to do was sit back, move when he had to, counter when he could. And overall, he looked like he troubled Williams with every clean shot he landed. Now, you can't give a guy like Eubank more confidence than he already has. Scoring those early knockdowns had that effect. And he basically walked the rest of the fight. He even dropped Williams in the 11th for good measure. I will say this. I didn't like the little rolls of flesh on Williams's back where his protector was fastened. I also didn't like the fact his trainer, Adam Booth, was absent for most of fight week, in front of the cameras at least. These were inklings in my mind that his preparation wasn't perfect. But at the end of the day, Eubank turned up in shape, as always. He stuck to his game plan and he stayed focused for the whole fight. And you can't ask more of a fighter than that. He's the well-deserved winner. Now, he says he wants Gennady Golovkin. It's 5 years too late, but why not? Now, did either of you guys catch this fight?
Yeah, I watched it. I was interested to get your opinion on this because obviously we was having the conversation while it was happening with Tino. He wasn't happy. I don't think he really likes Eubank, to be fair. I think that's the way it comes across to me. I'm just going to make an assumption about what Tino likes. But I would assume he likes a fighter that's going to stay in there. Do you know what I mean? Eubank is very light on his feet. He's very agile. He's very elusive. And perhaps those are traits that he doesn't really like in a fighter. But you have to say, he did box well when he needed to. And, you know, I think a lot of those scorecards that you saw perhaps said that, you know, Williams might have been winning the fight had he not got the knockdowns. What do you think about that?
Well, it's difficult to project because Dizzy did score the knockdowns. And I think he dropped Williams with the first meaningful punch he landed. Now, I was quite surprised at the size disparity between them. Liam Williams moving up from 154, as I've alluded to, he looked in good shape. Like, if you're just looking at him, he's got muscles, he looks good. But I did not like the look of his body. I feel like he looked a bit soft in places, which means perhaps he crashed a weight, perhaps he didn't rehydrate properly. He definitely looked undersized in the ring with Eubank, who's competed at 168. And got all the way, not all the way, but he's kind of a late sub. He got to the semifinals of the World Super 6 Championship where he lost to George Groves. So he's got the size and the engine and all that good stuff. I actually don't think Eubank's that light on his feet, but he was light enough on his feet in this fight. And he had the maneuverability to just catch Williams when he was charging in, because he was charging in a lot. This definitely wasn't the best version of Williams I've seen. I just called it wrong. I did not see this happening at all. I thought Williams was the better fighter outright, and fair play to Eubank. Absolutely made me eat my words.
And did it surprise you, like, how, I don't want to say he fell into Eubank's trap, but do you think from a sort of coaching and a sort of game plan perspective, like, it was just a case of Eubank got his spot on? He expected Williams to sort of walk onto these jabs, which were very, very similar. Those first three looked almost identical in how they went down. Do you know what I mean? It didn't look like a very powerful. It was just extremely well-timed. And it seemed to put Williams on his ass. Do you think it was a case of, all right, it was a really well-thought-out and well-executed game plan from the Eubank team? Or was it a case of it's just one of them and he just walked onto every punch, like, and it, and the timing and everything seemed to mar up, and there you go, he's dropped him three times and basically the fight's over?
It seemed to me that Eubank Jr. and his coach Roy Jones had worked on that specific shot. It was a weird kind of upward jab that kind of looked like halfway between a jab and a hook. And at a certain point where Williams would take that step, reaching with the right hand, he definitely looked like they'd worked on that scenario. But I also think there was an emotional component to the fight. Williams being at home in Cardiff, wanting to smash Eubank's face in, where Eubank was like aloof, really, but not bothered, not emotionally involved at all, despite all his talk. I don't think he gave a shit about being there. I don't think he gave a shit about being the away fighter. And I think that fed into his confidence even more. And then the early knockdowns, that fed into his confidence even more. And I think by the time they got to the fifth or sixth round, I couldn't see Williams putting a dent in him. So, yeah, I was impressed by Eubanks. Even though the 11th and 12th round, Williams was still there and plugging away. And then Eubanks kind of retreated into this kind of showboating shell, which was, you know, is what you want. Is securing his victory, really. That's kind of like a champion's mindset. But I understand and I agree with you that Tino doesn't like that. He would much rather a fighter close the show. As for Eubanks, a prospect after this, I'd have to look through the rankings, which I won't do now because we're getting on for time. But the Charlos, Golovkin, Canelo, do I fancy his chances against these guys? Probably not. Can I see him taking any of those fights? Maybe Golovkin. I certainly don't see him taking on Canelo anytime soon. Unrealistic proposition for Jake me. Paul. You know what? I think that would be perfect for Eubank. That would be perfect for him. Mega money fight. But then, from Jake Paul's perspective, probably not worth it. Do you know what I mean? But I think that would absolutely be a sick move for both of them. But moving on to later on in the night, and we saw the return of Keith Thurman after 2.5 years out of action with twice the muscle and half the hair that he had against Manny Pacquiao a couple of years ago. Very strange, but he looked bodied up. I don't know if he's been on the steads or you tell me, mate. But his opponent, Mario Barrios, this was his first appearance at welterweight since losing to Gervonta Davis in June last year. One of the commentators raised a very good point while the fight was going on. It's interesting that Gervonta Davis, the much smaller, lighter fighter, was able to knock Barrios out, but Keith Thurman couldn't. And of course, you could attribute that to a host of causes, but Thurman was definitely trying his best to get the knockout. He left Barrios looking like a Klingon general. His nose was swollen up to like that much, man. But he was still standing at the final bell. And other than a sporadic body attack and a few good jabs, Barrios just really couldn't do anything with Thurman, who showed decent enough movement. Not as much as I'm used to seeing, but decent enough. He was increasingly inventive with his combinations as the fight wore on, and he still hits with enough power to dissuade Barrios from rushing in. Now, the Errol Spence fight is the obvious one to wonder about for Thurman, but Spence is still recovering from that eye injury. I think your Dennis Ugas is the better option for him, both stylistically. And for Thurman to beat the man that beat Pacquiao a couple of months ago, that would wipe a little bit of the dirt off the only loss of his career so far. So I was happy to see Thurman back. I've always been a big fan. I like his style. I like, even though his power doesn't quite last at the top level, I still find him quite entertaining, even though he does my head in when he gets on the microphone. So we'll move on to the preview from next week and sticking to my guns for the ONE Championship previews. That's back on Friday with the Bad Blood card. And I still maintain they have the best names for their pay-per-views. It's going to be headlined by Dream, Bantam and Featherweight champion, former, and current two-time ONE Bantamweight champion, Bibiano Fernandez. Now, this guy is Demetrius Johnson's main sparring partner. He's ranked as number 5 Bantamweight in the world by MMA Weekly, with Fight Matrix naming him the number 1 Bantamweight outside the UFC. Cheers, Wikipedia, for that. And he'll defend his belt against John Lineker, who's 3-0 since moving over to ONE from the UFC. His losses in recent years have only come to the very, very best in his division, TJ Dillashaw and Corey Sanhagen. And he's a very aggressive, powerful fighter, so that should be decent. Now, on Saturday is the UFC 271, which I know we're all very much excited about. Headlined by Israel Adesanya versus Robert Whittaker, the rematch for the middleweight championship. So I'll turn it over to you guys. What do you think? I think, Flynn, I'll go with you first. What are you expecting out of this?
Not sure what to expect. As we were talking just before we started the episode, I watched the build-up video for this. So Adesanya got the knockout in the previous matchup, didn't he, against Whittaker? So in the hype video, it was saying he's had a lot of wins since. He's gotten a lot better. His chin's gotten better. So at first I was thinking Izzy's got it, but I'm not sure now. I'm not sure. I think Whittaker could come back. What do you reckon, Biss?
24 and 5 years. Obviously he's had three wins since that loss to Adesanya in 2019. Beat Darren Till, Jared Cannonier, Calvin Gastelum. So I'm just happy to see, or I'm looking forward to see Adesanya back, to be fair. He's such a great fighter to watch stylistically. And he's got that sort of, it's that arrogance of watching Eubank on the weekend and the sort of like arrogance he held in the ring. And I think Adesanya brings a bit of that as well. Do you know what I mean? It's nice to see fighters that have that. Do you know what I mean? And they really have that sort of like, and he looks great stylistically. Obviously he beat Marvin Vettori last time out, which I think is a great victory. He's only got that one loss to Jan Blachowicz, where he stepped up, I think it was to light heavyweight. So you can't really sort of begrudge him of that. It's just hard to see anybody really beating him in that division. I just don't think anyone's really there ready to beat him yet. So what do you think, Jim?
Well, as we said at the top of the boxing, I haven't picked a winner since Nam, and I'm better at picking winners in boxing than I am in the UFC. But I'll give you my opinion anyway.
Does it bode well then?
Yeah, I know, yeah. But I would say that Robert Whittaker has a more well-rounded MMA skill set, and Israel Adesanya is much more of a specialist. I would also say that this rivalry is similar to John Jones and Daniel Cormier, in that Adesanya is the taller fighter, he's the longer fighter, and he knows how to use those attributes to the best of advantage. And that if he didn't exist, Robert Whittaker would probably be considered the best middleweight of the last 25 years or something like that. As it happens, Whittaker's unlucky enough to be competing in the same era as someone like Adesanya, who has those attributes and is probably bigger and outright better than he is. Now, that's not to say that Whittaker can't win this fight. I mean, look, how often does the UFC and MMA in general produce the shock upsets and just drama and all those things that are inherent in a cage fight? I wouldn't rule any outcome out here. But I do think that, as you say, Israel Adesanya, his confidence, is he really going to be less confident after that first fight? I think he's going to come in here, and he said in the media, I'm going to look to put in some work here. He scored a spectacular knockout in that first fight, and he says he wants to outdo that. I think he's conscious of the Yoel Romero fights, of losing to Jan Blachowicz, as you said, Bissett. It's hard to get inside on him. It's hard to get anywhere near him. He's chopping at your front leg. He's feinting. He's jabbing. He's switching his stances. He's skirting around the edge of the cage. Fucking good luck getting anywhere near him. Now, if anyone can do it at middleweight, it's Robert Whittaker. Marvin Vettori managed to pin him down a couple of times, managed to take him down, hold him there. Dan Hardy pointed out Israel Adesanya has a 66% takedown defense rating, but also in his last two or three fights, he's been held down for like 7 minutes or something like that. Or it might be even more. I might be skewing the stats slightly, but he made the point that once you get Israel Adesanya on his back, he's nowhere near as effective as when he's standing up, playing with the range and doing all that mad kickboxer shit that you can do. I'm looking forward to this fight, very much so.
I think that showed, obviously, Blachowicz and Vettori to an extent has shown the recipe for how to beat him. It's just a case of whether you can get him there in the first place, isn't it? Because obviously nobody's going to beat him going toe-to-toe with him. So they're going to have to use the takedowns. They're going to have to be very clever about how they do it. But I would imagine that he's a lot of his training camp's been in preparation for this, because, you know, I don't think he or his team are like oblivious to the fact that that's how Whittaker's going to approach his game plan, you would assume. And, you know, obviously he's been in the media, or it's come out in the media that he's saying he felt bored in the fights between Blachowicz and Vettori. perhaps down to the fact that he was, you know, on the ground multiple times. And obviously, that's not a position where he wants to be. And I think from a visual perspective and sort of like, you know, getting the fans like involved in sport, and we want to see fighters that can go toe to toe and see all the great things that he does, both with his hands and with his kicks. So from a visual perspective, that's what people want to see. But in terms of them getting the win, which is what they're going to be looking at, they're going to look to probably get him on the takedown. So if you're going to call it, Jim, which way are you going to call it?
I think Adesanya is going to win this fight. But also, I'll make the point that going toe-to-toe, you might think that just means striking and throwing down just means excitement. But think about someone like Charles Oliveira and what he did to Dustin Poirier and what he did to Michael Chandler. Think about what Khabib did. You can be exciting and you can grapple. It's all about being aggressive and advancing your position. So I would just like to make that point quickly as a bit of a sidebar. I think Whitaker's got a big job on his hands, and I think Israel Adesanya at middleweight holds all the cards, so it's very difficult for me to pick against him. I would also say that the undercard for this event is underwhelming. There's Derek Lewis versus Ty Tuivasa, or Tuivasa, however you say that. There's also Jared Cannonier, who's also fought Robert Whittaker, as we said. Derek Brunson, who's fought Israel Adesanya and also beat Darren Till recently, and Kevin Holland. That's rounding off the main card. I will watch those fights, but I can't say I'm that excited about either of them. But that same night, back to the boxing, we'll have one of the more random fights I've seen made recently. We've got the UK's John Ryder versus the guy who used to be called the Golden Child, now the Miracle Man since his recovery from cancer, Danny Jacobs. That's at Ali Pali. This is like a why not kind of fight. Something to do on a Saturday if you've got nothing else to do. Jacobs turned pro 15 years ago, and he looked every bit of 35 years of age against Gabe Rosado last time out. He's operated at the very top of the middleweight division for a long time, but hasn't looked quite the same at super middleweight, which is 168 pounds, Canelo's current stomping grounds. Ryder should probably have a world title to his name already after his effort against Callum Smith in 2019. But no big name, no dice on that one, unfortunately. But that's boxing, that's the way it goes. As for the fight, instinctively, I think Jacobs should still have enough hand speed and general ring smarts to deal with Ryder. That being said, Ryder's not a man you want in front of you if you're having an off night or you're in the middle of a gradual decline. So we'll see. And this is an unusual fight, but I find it quite compelling. I'll definitely be tuning in. I'm not altogether sure where the winner goes, because how are they going to be rewarded for winning? Is either man, similar to Eubank, is either man realistically going to face Canelo next for one of those belts? Possibly. But Canelo's already scored Jacobs, and you wouldn't fancy Ryder's chances any more than Avni Yildirim, like at the beginning of last year. So I'll be watching, but I'm not sure about how this affects the larger super middleweight picture. But yeah, that's it. That's it for the roundup. On to before next week, where we're going to preview Kell Brook versus Amir Khan, the fight that happened probably 10 years too late, similar to Mayweather Pacquiao. So we'll be tuning in for that one.
Yep, sounds good, mate. And obviously, we're going to do the results, hopefully, if we get put it out there and get a few more responses for the top 10. WhatsApp groups with the lads and get them to do it. We'll see. We've had a few issues with it, obviously. But we're going to put it out there, see what happens. We might get back to the results of that. If not, you'll be on to another episode next week. So once again, good to hear off you, lads. And thanks for listening.
Cheers, guys.
Pleasure.